I'm just going to say good morning and welcome all back. Some people are coming just for today. Again, you'll understand that people are going to be coming in and out. One thing I'm going to say to you is if you know somebody on our list downstairs who hasn't attended, would you please tell them that next time, please let us know? Because there was a waiting list of about 100 people for this event. And I think some people are very disappointed. But those of you who are here, thank you so much for your attendance. And I would, without further ado, let Professor Ali start the proceedings.
Thank you very much, Joan. Good morning, everyone. It's my great pleasure to chair this morning's panel, and we're going to shift gear slightly and look at Gertrude Bell from a different angle, a woman in a man's world. And I just a few words to start out with. I mean, I think just having listened to the various papers over the last couple of days, and unfortunately I missed the film yesterday, but everyone told me it was brilliant, so I hope I'll get a chance to see it later. It's very clear that Gertrude Bell is a woman of contradictions and tensions and complexities. I mean, we all are, but when I look at those pictures of one... but when I look at those images of her being the only woman, you know, amongst the 39 or 40 thieves of Baghdad, so to speak, and the various other pictures of her picnicking with King Faisal and so on, gender is written all over it. And it is very clear that Gertrude Bell is a manifesting, or we can learn a lot about the intersections of nationality, being British in Iraq, class, her specific class standing, but also her gender. And I think I think Rainer Lewis' work on Orientalism, gendering Orientalism and rethinking Orientalism, really kind of addressed some of the blind spots in terms of, you know, the earlier work. I think feminist scholars for a long time have challenged the idea of women being natural peacemakers. So we are not assuming that when we see a woman that she's nicer or more prone to, you know, making peace. And also when you think about women and power, I think many people in this country think about Margaret Thatcher or the Margaret Thatcher syndrome, which is not only her, in the sense that often when you have women in a man's world, in, you know, decision-making positions, often, assume very, actually, elbow, macho, masculinist traits, traditional, conventional masculinist traits. So I think this is a time to more carefully explore Gertrude Bell, a woman in a man's world, to look at some of the contradictions. I mean, in some ways, she seems to be ahead of her time. She seems to be visionary. In other ways, she seems to be absolutely reactionary. Okay, I mean, fine that she's not a feminist and not involved in women's rights, but she is even actively opposed to women getting political rights. So how do we explain that? Is it the syndrome like the migrants when you come in and you start to get your rights and you close the door behind you? How do we understand these complexities, or her addiction to risk, the extreme mountaineering, traveling through bandit-ridden areas? Love, relationships. We heard on the first day that she didn't have many relationships, but then we also heard that she went to travel because she was in love with someone who was married. So I think there are lots of very interesting aspects to it, but I'm not going to take more time, and I'm very, really very happy and I'm pleased to introduce the first speaker. I've heard a lot of Dr. Tamara Shalabi, and I'm really happy to finally meet her, and I think she's doing us all proud in terms of sort of the new a way to look at Iraqi art and culture really from a more cultural studies perspective. And today, Dr. Chalabi is going to speak to us about Fragments of a Mirror, the Writings of Gertrude Bell. Thank you.
Thank you. Morning. I don't have any pictures to show. I wanted to thank, first of all, the British Institute for organizing this and for having me here. And if I may, I'd like to start with a personal connection, a personal story that's relating to Gertrude and myself, if I can say that. She's been a dilemma for me personally over the last 10 years since the Iraq War. And I have to say, I resorted to her writings in the aftermath of 2003, which was the very first time I'd ever been to Baghdad. I'm part Iraqi. almost as a way of, she presented me, especially her letters, as a lifeline to understanding Baghdad, or more precisely, to humanizing it. A city I'd only grown up hearing about, when I finally saw it after 2003, I have to confess I was hugely disoriented and somewhat disappointed. It didn't measure up to all the stories I had growing up, etc., embellishment of memory, exile, and so on. And this is notwithstanding, obviously, the multitude of challenges and disasters the city and its people had gone through. I resorted to Gertrude's letters specifically, to her writing about the life and color of the city many decades ago, the orange orchards, on the river banks, the dusk, the sunrise, the colorful local characters she brought to life with her pen. She allowed me to connect, ironically, in a more palpable way to the city. And it seemed much like her letters allowed me, much like an archaeologist discovering a relic that hints at a tremendous story that was long gone. So I was, and somewhat still am, grateful for her help, and that gratitude led to some enthusiasm back in 2006 when I decided to look for her grave. It took me many months, and my experience was that no one knew of Gertrude Bell, which was a shock. I mean, the locals, I'm talking about people who knew Baghdad, walked around, everybody said, maybe Miss Bell, they had this special pronunciation, they thought they'd heard of her, maybe they hadn't. Anyway, it took a few months, and First, I went to the British Military Cemetery, somewhat assuming she'd be there with Maud, maybe had her own cenotaph. I fantasized about what kind of grave she had and was bitterly disappointed to find out that she wasn't there. It was a cemetery of men of the army, and even though she carried rifles in the desert, she wasn't a soldier. She was irrelevant. I mean, people really didn't know very much about... I mean, they didn't. And then I stumbled upon a resourceful Baghdadi from old Baghdad and said, oh, of course, yes, you know, there's another Anglican cemetery and maybe she's there, whatever. Anyway, we went there. I went there with him and another man and met the caretaker who had been grown up in the cemetery. His father had been taking care of the cemetery prior, and his name was Abu Ali, and he, you know, pointed to her grave, which was half destroyed, and in this very arid cemetery that was neglected, and I felt extremely moved and sad by this. Anyway, as a result, I tried to restore it without touching any of the effect, you know, the actual stone with the elegant calligraphy, and planted trees around it because I knew, and flowers because she loved botany and gardening. I mean, she was such an avid gardener, and I'm in touch with Abani, and I still help out in maintaining it. So it's been, I have pictures usually, but I've had a technical problem, so I can't show you any of them. But it's been a very strange relationship to a grave, to stones, to relics. So I thought it was an interesting and bizarre introduction to Gertrude Bell. And just on this point, finally, I thought it was, she didn't have a very, very long life, but she had a very rich and interesting life. And she, and I think her life began way before Iraq. In fact, Iraq was her last station. And she, interestingly, just as a side note to this, she was born on the 14th of July, 1868. Although she died on the 12th of July, she was buried on the 14th of July, 1926, which is quite an interesting date because the revolution, the monarchy that she helped create was overthrown on the 14th of July, 1958. So I don't know if there's any symbolism there. Anyway, moving on. Well, I've already eaten up my time before starting, but anyway, I wanted to really, the paper that I prepared is really more of reflections rather than any kind of solid answers about her role vis-a-vis her contemporaries, specifically in terms of writing, specifically Lawrence, whose book was much embellished, The Seven Pillars of Wisdom, and I wondered why, although her more interesting and known book, The Desert and the Stone, was published many years before Lawrence's, and didn't have the same sense of drama and adventure per se with the Arab Revolt, but it certainly had, was a very wide-ranging book, and it just made me wonder why of course, understandably, Lawrence had a lot of publicity on his hand. He had Thomas Lowell, the American journalist, who promoted him, you know, even during the war, so really one of the first early TV war heroes. And wondered why, you know, even in the description of The Desert of the Sun, it says the extraordinary adventures of the female Lawrence of Arabia. I mean, I felt offended on her behalf. I mean, she was traveling way before him. So why is it that, you know, for his is a classic, while hers is sort of something a bit more recherché, we don't really know about it. The second point I wanted to talk about, which obviously I'm not going to have a lot of time, is her relationship to archaeology. Why was she attracted to archaeology? Why? I mean, we just assumed that she was an archaeologist, but why was she attracted to archaeology? And there's, you know, here I have to sort of mention, you know, archaeology is a story of the past, and as we know, there is a lot more physical proof rooted in archaeology than in history, for example. Presented with undefined objects, archaeologists have to dig into the unknown, sometimes in frustration, until clues lead to some kind of story simulation. And of course, there's been a lot of reference to archaeology in psychoanalysis, Freud specifically, and it's interesting to locate Bell within this field. The fact that she, in many ways, was such a reserved woman in her published writings, I'm not referring to her letters at this point, and this need to constantly dig back into the past to find some narrative, some story. You know, what does it mean? Where, you know, in terms of, if we put her in the context of today, was she someone who was, let's say, a depressive? Did she have an identity crisis? I mean, all these terminologies that we use so easily today. You know, in her time, you know, this was a very, it was a field in its infancy. I'm talking about, you know, psychology, therapy, etc., or psychoanalysis. And it just makes one wonder. I mean, she encountered the East for the very first time at the age of 24 in Persia, not the Ottoman Empire, which, you know, she met a very brilliant non-Western civilization. But it was also the place where she fell in love for the very first time. And that love was in the form of Henry Cadogan, a British diplomat, who was refused by her father, and so she obediently gave him up. He died 9 months later. And so in a way, her introduction to the East was already a place of contradiction. It was a place of love and fantasy and life, but also of death and ruin. And so she started off with a story already buried there, and I think that's quite telling and probably informs a lot of the rest. We yesterday there was Miriam talked about, you know, the love of the desert and the fascination with that, and of course, I mean, this is, you know, not unique to, it's a general British syndrome, but, you know, overall European, but more specifically British, I think. And, I mean, again, the desert, was it a place that reflected her inner world? Was she, you know, a lot of questions come up. It was an empty place for most of the time where she could impregnate with her fantasy, vivid imagination, her knowledge. Was it a place of you know, her closest connection to spirituality? She was known to be an atheist, and quite a proud one, and a vocal one, rather. And you know, was this the closest thing she could connect to something beyond, you know, the known? I just wanted to say about the archaeology part that it struck me from the two public, well, she's had many publications, but the two major works she did were on Uchaydr, which was the palace in near Karbala in Iraq, and earlier on the 50 Byzantine churches in Karaman in Turkey, the 1001 churches. And both of these are monumental. They're monuments. They're not. She never participated in a dig. She never. I mean, she passed through digs. She visited digs, but she never really dug. And I think again, there's questions to be raised around that. I mean, she was. You know, so this is monuments that relate to power, to empire. You know, the first one is about, you know, the churches are Byzantium, a great empire. Then, you know, with the Uchaydr, she was confused. Was it Sasanian? Was it early Abbasid? And if it was early Abbasid, was there the Sasanian connection? It was, you know, the beginning of the Islamic, you know, if you like, the empire, the Islamic civilization that rose. And
in a way, her definition as an archaeologist, I wonder if she is precisely, you know, that. I mean, she did a lot of map making. We know she was a very quick learner. We know that she learned how to draw maps, draft maps very quickly. So that, for example, you know, that there's been some arguments put forward that she couldn't be in a dig because it was, you know, a man's world, etc. I don't believe that, because she obviously didn't care at all about, you know, she risked her life so many times, and, you know, I mean, the whole journey to Ha'il is one, you know, dramatic story. So again, one wonders. I mean, you know, there is a relationship to power that's even reflected in the archaeological interest that she acquired, that I just thought would be worth examining. Sorry, there's a lot more to say about this, but I know I'm running out of time. And the last sort of theme I wanted to mention, and I'll mention it briefly, is her relationship to men. I mean, very obvious. And I think really is worthy of a paper, of a subject on its own. I think there's so much extrapolation from her letters, psychological, I mean, that's way beyond the scope of this paper. And had we only had her official and published books, I think we would have looked at her very differently, because I think, obviously, there's a certain barrier. She's talking to an audience, another persona comes in, etc. I think her letters really give her away. And even her letters, there's a very different consistency. She wrote to her parents in a particular way, especially to her father. She ranges between being very childish, very adoring. In fact, I think in many ways she was a Shahrazad to her father. She needed to keep his attention all the time, going, you know, entertaining him with stories. And obviously she held up a certain cheerfulness most of the time. And I mean, one is fascinated by how she, you know, very quickly sucked it up, obeyed his, you know, order not to marry Cadogan, and just sort of cheerfully carried on, at least with him. I mean, so there's certain inhibitions that could never be broken through with her father, even though she does mention at times that it was very, very difficult. Obviously, the relationship with her father is, I think, the most interesting one, but this need, you know, and linked to it, I think, is this need for her to be a person with a capital P. And I think one of the first times she writes about it is when she's in Mount Carmel in 1902, and she writes that, "I am much entertained to find that I am a person in this country. They all think I was a person. And one of the first few questions everyone seems to ask everyone else is, 'Have you seen Miss Bell?' Then, almost by way of apology for her enthusiasm, she concludes, 'Renown is not very difficult to acquire here.'" Later on, you know, when she's in Basra in 1916, which is, I think, the very first time she encounters directly working with men and finds it very, very difficult, she hints at it initially and says, you know, it's not, again to her father, "It's not easy being here. Someday I will tell you about it, perhaps." And then more defensively, she adds, "All you can really do for people is to give them the opportunity of making a place for themselves. The V, I think it's in reference to Cox, has done simply that for me." Does she always have to remind him that she's still his little girl, that she can't kind of exceed him, even though in many ways she's much more famous than him? And I just thought to mention here very quickly some of the, for example, the reactions of British men, who I think were far more sexist towards her, because obviously she was of their world, than any Arab man she encountered, with the exception of maybe Ibn Saud, who was not at all complimentary of her. Mark Sykes, who we know well, he also wrote the Sykes-Picot Agreement, and quite vocal about his disdain for the Arabs, which was one of the reasons she initially fell out with him, found her objectionable and described her as the silly chattering windbag of conceit, gushing, flat-chested, man-woman, globe-trotting, rump-wagging, blethering ass. General McClellan later writes, mentions her as the little wisp of a human being said to be a woman. And I think, you know, this is, you know, very harsh stuff. It's really powerful. And I mean, said to be a woman, does it? And I've encountered quite a few men who, when I mention Gertrude, you know, dismiss her in such a way that scholars, that I find, you know, shocking, because ultimately I think because she was a woman and had no place, and so her judgments, her writings, everything was within the context of the fact that she just was an intruder into this world. And of course, I've often wondered whether, from the Orientalist perspective, whether she wrote about the Orient differently because she was a woman. I'm not really sure, because I think she was able to suspend, in a way, her gender at some points. For example, in the desert, she was treated as an equal. She mentions, for example, going, when she passes through the Jebel al-Druz in Syria, when she writes gushingly about Yahya Beg, she also mentions that he says, when, asking villagers, "Have you seen a queen traveling, a consuless?" So the desert was her playground, and in a way, these Arab men, the Bedouin sheikhs, noble as they may be, mighty as they may be, were perhaps, the toys that she was able to play with. I mean, I don't know, I might be being a bit harsh, but I think there's a lot to be said about her relationship with Arab men, which is a very different kettle of fish than her relationship with English, her counterparts. And obviously the most interesting relationship amongst those is really the one, with Faisal. Yes, she was gushing, people in Baghdad love, from the records at the time, love to say that she, they had a story, she was in love with him. I think it's more a question, I mean, she was 17 years older than him, it's more a question of I think, Faisal becoming an extension of herself in a way, like a mother with a child, a projection of herself. So it became a very personal story, and she was very maternal, and he was the king in view of her becoming really the queen. I mean, she was the queen behind. She talks about being the queen, and another letter tellingly, her stepmother sends her the family tiara, and she says, "I'd forgotten how fine it is. I feel in wearing it, I may be taken for the uncrowned queen of Mesopotamia." I mean, so there's these ideas, and just a couple of quotes, with reference to Faisal, which the relationship just does change in the way that he's often like a child, unyieldy, capricious, possibly not particularly, as he grows into his role, as he's sort of representing Iraq, defending Iraq, becoming more Iraqi, and this is where the ambiguity starts to be less ambiguous, perhaps within her role, but. And I quote here, "Faisal, with his high ideals, his fair conception of the Arab cause, which he alone represented and defended, acutely sensitive to sympathy or political antagonism, tries to hold his own against the covert hostility of the French and the ardent folly of his adherents. Harassed by his family, deserted by the British government, without one single person near him for which he could seek affection and impartial guidance." She wanted to be that person for him, and then she really wanted to mother him. When he goes to Ramadi to meet the Sunni sheikhs there, she says, "I never saw him looking splendid, so splendid." There's adoration. We know all about the coronation from yesterday. She acted as his costume maker. She, organized his house. She decided the menu for the first party he hosted in Baghdad. She found the tailors. I mean, these are all roles that, sometimes, a mother takes to take care of her child. And also when he as I mentioned, when he starts walking in a way, when he needs her less and less, is when her position becomes less, more tenuous. There's a feeling of abandonment, and I'll just quote this finally. And this is in relation to, for when Faisal was not listening and did not agree with the whole way in which they wanted him to accept the mandate and present it to the people, etc. In 1922, she says, "I was to her father again. I was playing my last card and told him so. I began by asking whether he believed in my personal sincerity and devotion to him. He said he could not doubt it. I said I had formed a beautiful and gracious snow image to which I had given allegiance, and I saw it melting before my eyes. I could not wait until the villains in whom he put his trust in inevitably blackened me in his eyes. On this theme, we had a terrific discussion during which he kissed my hand at several intervals, which is very disconcerting. I'm still sous le coup of this interview. Faisal is one of the most lovable human beings, but he's amazingly lacking in strength and character. I've left him tonight convinced that one of my desires is to serve him, and tomorrow he will be full of doubts again." I mean, she also thought he was incredibly courageous and very noble. I mean, and I think these can't be taken as, final statement. It's just, again, reflections of thought. she, as I mean, the debate over her dying. I mean, I'm of the camp that believes that she committed suicide for sure. I mean, the loneliness, she writes about it. She wrote about it to Domhnall, her friend, who she tended to write more of the her honest kind of, you know, less cheerful notes. She couldn't escape it. I mean, yes, there was the dying fortunes. I mean, the losing fortunes of her family. They lost a lot of money. She was already ill with this disease I can never pronounce, pleurisy. One, you know, it's been suggested that maybe she actually had cancer, and you know, I'm convinced that she was definitely, in today's terminology, a manic depressive. I mean, there are great highs and great lows, and you see that in the writing throughout. She came to a kind of a modus vivendi with Faisal towards the end. You know, he needed her less. She was unofficially still advisor. And she resorted back to that first love that probably never disappointed her, archaeology. She, you know, her greatest lasting monument to Iraq. In fact, I think her archaeological monument was Iraq, I mean, itself. But I mean, within that, the museum and the antiquities law. And it was, in a way, that was their peacemaking. You know, she became honorary advisor, honorary director of the antiquities with his blessings, and they, you know, she drafted the antiquities law, which he adopted. And her days were spent tirelessly working at her own peril. And I think really she could not bear to live, and again, in relation to men, I don't think she could bear to live and have her father die before she died. I think this was a very big concern. You know, he was aging. Her brother had died, tragically, half-brother had died a few months beforehand. And, you know, it was too much. So in terms of how, ultimately, I think she ultimately paid the price of being a woman, lonely, unmarried. She desired children. She loved her nieces and nephews. She was very interested in them. And so although she did stick out in the man's world, here we are talking about her two-day conference and still a lot of controversy, I think she finally paid the price of being a woman in that time and age. Thank you.
Thanks so much, Tamara, for extremely fascinating and moving paper. Now, during this conference, and often Gertrude Bell is a window to look into Iraq and the history of Iraq or the relationship between Britain and Iraq. But of course, Gertrude Bell, we also learn about Britain and British women. And I think this next paper by Professor Helen Barry is actually going to focus on the question of what does Gertrude Bell tell us about British history. Thank you.
Thank you. Well, good morning, everyone, and thank you very much to the organisers for the invitation to speak at this really very splendid conference today. And I should start by confessing that I'm actually not an expert on Iraq, nor indeed of modern British history, so why am I here? I'm primarily an expert on 17th and 18th century British history, but I walk past a poster at Newcastle University that reminds me on a daily basis that we have this marvellous archive on our doorstep, and I'm afraid I've been rather seduced by it. I do teach women's and gender history as part of my many research interests, and as you'll see, I have a particular focus at the moment on an exhibition which celebrates the inspirational women of Northeast England. So I'll say more about that in a moment. How's the volume? Can you hear me okay at the back? Okay, thank you. So the year 2013 marks the centenary of the death of an almost exact contemporary of Gertrude Bell's, Emily Wilding Davidson, whose photograph you see on the right here. Bell was born in 1868, Emily Davidson in 1872, and both women hailed from Northeast England. Bell studied modern history at Oxford and gained the equivalent of a first. Davidson studied English literature and natural sciences at Oxford, then gained a first in modern languages at Royal Holloway, University of London. But their social worlds and their politics could not have been more dissimilar. Davidson's Northumbrian background was lower middle class, Bell's distinctly patrician as the daughter of a wealthy Teesside ironmaster. Davison was a militant suffragette who was active in the Women's Social and Political Union, who notoriously was killed after apparently trying to pin a suffragette banner to the King's Horse at the Epsom Derby. Bell was a founder member of the Northern branch of the Women's National Anti-Suffrage League, an organisation that campaigned against votes for women, fronted by notable establishment figures, including Bell's close personal friend, Lord Cromer. Both Bell and Davison have been chosen to feature in a new exhibition, Inspirational Women of Northeast England, which launches this month at the Hatton Gallery at Newcastle University. So one of our aims for the exhibition is to raise awareness both locally and nationally about Gertrude Bell and the remarkable archive of documents, personal writings and photographs held at our university that form an important part of her legacy. So here is one inspirational woman of Northeast England, Kat Copeland, who was an Olympic gold medalist at the London 2012 Games and is a rower. She's included in our exhibition. And we've got to wonder where we're going to place Bell in this exhibition, where we're actually going to hang her image. And one idea that we've had is to put her alongside Bryony Balin. Now, in 2011, Bryony, who's pictured here, became the youngest woman to reach the South Pole on a solo expedition, aged just 19, while still a geography undergraduate at Newcastle University. But the juxtaposition of Gertrude Bell and Emily Davison, I think, would be more problematic and uneasy one. Would Bell have accepted being grouped within a category of other historical and present-day subjects, among whom the only common denominator is that they are and were all women? As Denise Riley argued influentially some years ago, creating the category of woman, as in woman explorer, woman archaeologist, woman diplomat, raises significant objections and can even undermine the feminist project of celebrating women's achievements, given the refusal or silence on the subject of gender on the part of those women who are selected and thus categorised. So her own putative objections notwithstanding, this paper presents an analysis of the ways in which Gertrude Bell negotiated the challenges she faced as a lone woman in the male world of diplomacy and high politics, a scholar, an adventurer, who rode roughshod over the conventional doctrine of separate spheres, which dictated that those of her own sex were supposed to be confined to the domestic realm. In doing so, the aim is to develop a different perspective on Bell's motivation and success as a historical actor, whose influence extended far beyond the vast majority of women of her generation. This paper proposes that she developed three main strategies for exerting authority as a woman. Firstly, based upon the natural respect she demanded because of her social rank, she felt. Secondly, her Oxford education. And thirdly, the force of her personality. It focuses on Bell's own accounts of her travels and involvement in anti-suffrage campaigning before the First World War, and presents the hypothesis that her strategies for dealing with men in authority were forged in a variety of contexts, from the drawing room to the desert, long before she entered the diplomatic service. It addresses one of the most paradoxical aspects of her personality, her stand against women's political equality. In the analysis that follows, evidence is also drawn from her diaries, her correspondence, and photography from her pre-war travels. So we can trace the precedent for extraordinary English women travellers to at least the late 17th century and the perambulations of Celia Fiennes, who's an ancestor of Sir Ranulph Fiennes. Throughout the 18th and early 19th centuries, elite women could be grand tourists, though almost exclusively when accompanying their husbands or brothers, and seldom venturing further than France or Italy. Lady Mary Wortley Montagu, who's pictured here, was the wife of a British diplomat in the 18th century and preempted Gertrude Bell's travels in the Ottoman Empire by nearly 200 years. Montagu was the first to realise the potential for female authors to capture the general public's imagination with published accounts of her voyages, offering secret windows into the enclosed world of the harem. Montagu's writings anticipated Bell's photography among the enclosed women she encountered, such as the two wives of Mustafa Pasha, whom she met while Bell met while travelling from Baghdad to the Persian border in March 1911, and who complained to her of their imprisonment in their household, which they never left, And there's also Bell's famous photographs of Turkiya, a Circassian woman, quote, who was sent to Muhammad al-Rashid by the Sultan as a gift. Bell noted, quote, all the women are closely veiled here. But she revealed in her letters that underneath Turkiya's hijab, quote, she was dressed in brilliant red and purple cotton robes, and she wore a rope of rough pearls around her neck. And Bell also says she was a terrible chatterbox, and I love the use of that word. Another haunting image, and it's very interesting that the woman here who is subject to Bell's gaze, if you like, is given her name, Turkiya. But these women, I think this image is much more problematic, and we've already seen this several times, not least in that wonderful documentary yesterday. These are unnamed tribeswomen of the harem of Muhammad Abu Tahir. In the tradition of Lady Mary Wortley Montagu, Bell's unveiling of Arab women, as here, was only possible because of the access granted by virtue of her sex. So I think this is a tension here. She's disavowing alliance with so-called women's causes, but it's her gender which is also granting her privilege access to certain spaces in which she's willing to exploit. And it's a peculiarly ambiguous position that she's occupying here. And I actually feel quite uncomfortable looking at this image. These are unnamed women, and we're also subjecting them to our gaze in the present day. We don't even know their names. There was also a distinguished line of famous, though highly exceptional, women who long before Bell had challenged the notion that women were intellectually inferior to men or less able to function in the public realm of business and politics. Recent research by Rhea Snowden has revealed, for example, that the first printed edition of the Bible in Arabic was published by Sarah Hodgson, a Newcastle print tycoon who contemplated suing the SPCK when it threatened to withdraw her copyright. And we're talking here about the late 18th, 30s, 19th centuries. So there were precedents for well-known elite English women travellers, female scholars and businesswomen. But it's difficult to find a precedent for a woman who had multiple careers in quite the same way as Gertrude Bell, from mountaineering to archaeology, translation, diplomacy and literary scholarship. Unusually, when she began her serious travelling, and I just have to pause for a moment, I've just read T. Lawrence's comment that he didn't think Bell had much of a mind, you know. And that's seriously objectionable. I think we have to unpick these strategies for undermining women's achievements and you know, men's verdicts on women like that. I'm afraid we've actually heard some of them articulated at this conference, albeit in a gentle and amusing way. To call her an amateur, for example, they were all amateurs in this context, you know, particularly the Oxbridge-educated men who took great pride in saying, we are all amateurs. So let's not forget her expertise in the eight languages that she was fluent in. Unusually, when she began her serious travelling and archaeological photography, she was unmarried and unchaperoned by an older male relative, a single woman rather than a wife of a well-known diplomat or politician. This is not to underplay the significance of her family ties and network of powerful friends. Her travels began with a visit in 1888 to 89 to her stepmother's sister in Bucharest, whose husband, Sir Frank Lascelles, was then British Minister to Romania. And I'd also like to focus a little bit on her northeast roots. Two generations of Bells had helped to create and govern the industrial hinterland of the inner empire in the English provinces. Now, we haven't thought about this yet, but I think this is an important dimension if we're going to understand her attitudes and motivations. No better was this illustrated than in the book At the Works of 1907, her stepmother's detailed account of the Middlesbrough iron foundry upon which the Bell fortune was founded. The defence of working-class life and habits observed by Lady Bell had the same quasi-anthropological quality as her stepdaughter Gertrude's letters and diary entries that documented the habits, diet and customs of the Arab peoples. Both were a form of exoticism, records of the unfamiliar other, along class and, in the latter case, racial lines. Such discourses were also deeply gendered. Quote, a visit to a working man's home in Middlesbrough is where the man is keen about both his work and his leisure, where the wife is a competent manager and a good wife and mother, opined Lady Bell, expressing the widely held doctrine of separate spheres and seeing her own philanthropy as an extension of the appropriate maternal concern in the public realm. The rationale which was often given for women to become active in local government and charitable work, but not national politics, nor indeed international diplomacy. Ideas about womanhood, nation and empire were indeed deeply intertwined in Edwardian England. Many saw the differences between the sexes as natural, and that any major departure from women's roles as wives and mothers would bring social chaos to Britain and the empire. We haven't really unpicked this question of Britishness or the British imperial project, and I do accept that it is a lot about the fragility of the inner empire and this question of projection, which we've fruitfully been exploring. So it's this mindset which I think makes the anti-suffrage position by Bell and many of her contemporaries more intelligible, if not more sympathetic. As Lord Cromer, one-time president of the Men's League for Opposing Female Suffrage, argued, his opposition to votes for women stemmed not from prejudice but from, quote, his reverence for women. There was no more sense, he argued, in comparing women with men, quote, than there would be in comparing a Chippendale cabinet with a play of Shakespeare. Bell, of course, could not just sign a petition. She assumed a prominent and controversial role as secretary to the newly formed League of Anti-Suffragists. In a letter to the Times in October 1908, she urged action against, quote, the extraordinary and regrettable program being pursued by the suffragettes. Quote, I earnestly appeal to all men and women to lose no time in coming forward. She confidently predicted that a territorial army of Amazons will be needed to retard the progress of a society so successful as the Anti-Suffrage League. And indeed, it was successful at the time. Within a year, 95 branches had been formed nationwide and 9,000 subscriptions raised. Now, it's the First World War that effectively puts an end to the anti-suffrage campaign. But in that particular period, it experienced great success for a few years, and Bell was really spearheading that. In a recent study of the anti-suffrage movement, Julia Bush has proposed that women who supported this cause could be divided into three camps: the maternal reformers, the women writers, and those to whom she refers as imperialist ladies. Bush locates Gertrude Bell among the latter group, amid a range of prominent female anti-suffragists, including Violet Markham, Margaret Jersey, Ethel Colquhoun, Mary Kingsley, and Flora Shaw, arguing that their views about female suffrage were closely related to their opinions on empire and their relationships with male imperialists. She argues that both Bell and Violet Markham were imperial hero worshippers, single women who could not follow the model of imperial wifehood presented by Jersey and Colquhoun, although it's difficult to see why she does not categorise Bell, along with Kingsley and Shaw, as female anti-suffragists with a high public profile in their own right. So I think she's rather neglected the fact that Bell was a very well-known personality nationally because of her publications at that time. There is certainly, however, some mileage in the idea that Bell hero-worshipped her own father and men of a similar social standing and age in her milieu, especially Lord Cromer, whose opinions she relished, drawn from his first-hand experience in Egypt. Gertrude certainly modelled her opinions upon the men of her own class whom she admired and expressed a similar disgust with the antics of the suffragettes, quote, the Pankhursts and their acolytes. She also got very excited when Asquith got bloodied by a suffragette, which she witnessed firsthand at a reception in London. So I do think she really relished and actually got some degree of excitement and gratification from witnessing a spat and a direct confrontation. She seems to have enjoyed almost perversely taking public stands on controversial issues. Like Cromer, she relished being the apostle of unpopular causes. He, for example, saw no difficulty. As a vegetarian, I particularly love this one. He accepted the vice presidency of the RSPCA, even though he was in sharp conflict with its anti-vivisectionist members, a controversial position on animal rights which Gertrude relished sharing. So she was very much pro-vivisection. She loved nothing better than converting someone to her own point of view by force of argument, a skill which was honed via the Oxford tutorial system. In her diaries, she recorded a conversation on her travels with a Mrs. Broadbridge, and I think there is a little bit of a put down here. Quote, an intelligent little woman, wife of an engineer. She had been all over the world. We talked of the suffrage, and I enlisted her amongst the aunties. A poor woman, she was just on a train, and that's Gertrude Bell, isn't it? Gertrude's own family, acknowledged that at times her Oxfordy manner needed toning down. She even tried to persuade her brother Hugo, as I'm sure you know, to become an atheist, and he subsequently entered the church. Her intellectualism and education legitimized, as I think she saw it, entering the field of male rational discourse, and was the first of three strategies she regularly deployed in traditionally masculine affairs. On hazardous occasions, she appealed to the highest official available. This looks like a pretty hazardous occasion to me. She describes this encounter with Kurdish tribesmen as they were bristling with arms and also very handsome. This is not a woman who's a dried-up old stick, okay, or just maternal, her feelings of Faisal, you know, oh, lovely and maternal, pat, pat. You know, she could still fancy him, 17 years younger, though he may have been. And I think, you know, there is this erotic kind. The reason I'm highlighting this is a three-dimensional, full-blooded woman that we're talking about here. This is not a brain on a stick, but this is something that she had to negotiate. You know, and she had love affairs, successful or unsuccessful, however posterity might judge us all on those grounds. We are all trapped by our own gender and have to work our way through it. Bristling with arms and very handsome, this group of tribesmen. On another occasion, when she had her rifle seized from her servant Fatah by an officious policeman in the bazaar at Hilla, Gertrude recorded, "I went at once to the head of police and pointed out that every Arab in the desert carries a rifle, and as we had come through the desert, I had to carry arms. He did not capitulate, however, so she went above his head to the Kaimakam Namuk Beg, to whom she instantly befriended and undertook an inspection of the local school together. She concluded, having heard him express sound political opinions, he is a man." So she has agency here in defining the gendered acceptability or otherwise of the men that she's encountering, and I think that's a very empowering thing for her to be doing. She is constantly judged as a woman, but she's also making judgments about the masculinity of the Arab and British men who she's encountering. So I don't think we should lose sight of that either. Bell's anomalous position as a lady traveller in potentially dangerous situations was not lost upon her. At the Euphrates near Kifil in Iraq, at the time when she was working at the Palace of Uqadir, she recounted in a letter to her father how her muleteers had to cross the river with horses. Quote, "The ferry boat was so small that the horses could not get into it. The muleteers took off most of their clothes and rode the horses over. The water came over the backs of the horses." So perhaps in recompense for the indecorous record of male nudity, she added, quote, "I crossed the ferry boat like a lady." But I think this is very arch. You know, she is consciously self-fashioning, constantly recounting her adventures and then reeling it back and saying, well, of course, like, this isn't very ladylike. And she's playing with this. Her diary entry for the 27th of March 1911 recorded her practicality when the men stripped to swim across the river with horses. Quote, "I fed the naked men on dates and covered them with horse clothing," which was a detail not recounted to her family. Bell was no prude, so I would just like to hit home, and I was amazed to find this image in the archive. This incredibly sensual, if not erotic, actually early photograph of Nina Rosen. And I think her aesthetics are clearly shaped here by perhaps some of the art she'd encountered in Paris and the development of the photography of people like Julia Margaret Cameron. She's not shying away from the human form. And, you know, I'm just hitting home here that this is a very complex person at work. So a third factor in Gertrude's ability to override the gendered expectations of her day was down to the sheer force of character. She had no compunction about debating high politics with powerful men, something encouraged from an early age by this man, Sir Hugh Lothian Bell, her father. So whether British or Arab, she relished discussing Mesopotamia and other sensible things and disparaged the small talk expected of women of her class. Her high status in the British government gave her the kudos of an honorary man who, by force of personality intelligence, could appear unveiled even among chief religious figures in the Islamic world, such as the revered Naqib of Baghdad. To many Arabs, she was known as Al-Khatun, the lady of the court, and her rivals in British government circles regarded her as a political troublemaker. But the men she encountered, British and Arab alike, acknowledged her shrewdness. on the rare occasion where she failed to win an argument, or when faced with belittlement on the grounds of her sex, she either ignored or overrode who was trying to stop her. When Wunmudiyah tried to block her way to Damascus, since she was trying to cross contested Druze territories, saying, "It cannot happen," Gertrude retorted in fluent Arabic, "It must happen. English women are never afraid." Having failed to secure his permission, she simply decamped in the middle of the night and stole away on her intended route. So there's the element here of the trickster, you know, the person who is occupying an uncertain space with uncertain status. She was not oblivious to the ambivalence shown to her by some men, both Arab and her compatriots, towards granting her the status of an honorary man. At dinner en route from Baghdad to the Persian border, again in March 1911, she was seated with visiting male dignitaries and was given the courtesy of her host, the Pasha, while she told them the news from Baghdad. Quote, "Though they were also cordial, and though we eat out of the same dish, I noticed they would not shake hands with me, and if I gave them anything, they carefully avoided touching my hands." So I think she was very aware that although she was given a tremendous amount of privilege, the element of the segregation of the sexes was still there, perhaps in very subtle ways. So in conclusion, Gertrude Bell, I think, is a paradox to modern eyes, but certain elements of her paradoxical character weren't as paradoxical if we view them in the context of her own day. She showed society what one woman could achieve, and yet she was a dedicated anti-suffragist who assumed a prominent role in the national campaign against votes for women. I think it's the primary reason why feminist historians have been slow to claim Bell as an icon, and why she remains a relatively unknown historical figure outside of the specialist worlds of Middle East archaeology and political history. As the historian Brian Harrison noted somewhat waspishly, "Conservatives show little of the feminists' and socialists' enthusiasm for hoarding up their own history in specialist journals." As a crusader for the anti-suffrage movement and an agent of British imperialism, Gertrude Bell is an unlikely candidate for rehabilitation among the feminist pantheon. That she was seemingly enthralled to a paternal form of patriarchy, as illustrated here with her father, is perhaps another contributory factor. I would say her first love was her father, actually. It wasn't archaeology. It was her father. And many of her exploits started within his sight, you know. "Look, Daddy, look at me. I can climb this mountain." As a crusader for the anti-suffrage movement, that she was, yes, it would perhaps be the mark of a mature 21st feminism if it is possible to cast a critical eye over her life and career without the impulse either to canonize or demonize her, but to understand her more fully within her own context, without fear of the imputation that we are celebrating the attitudes and values that have rightly not withstood the test of time. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Helen, for another fascinating paper. I think the two papers really worked extremely well together and complemented each other. We are running a bit late, but we're going to have 15 minutes for questions and comments, and what I'm going to do is just collect a few to start out with. Okay, so I have Roger first.
Roger Hardy, thank you both of you. I'm, as a sort of opening aside, I'm rather conscious of being chastised for using the word amateur, which, especially in this country, I don't regard as pejorative at all. I consider I'm an amateur. But just very briefly to try and say what I meant by it, I think there is a legitimate distinction, at least I hope there is, between amateur and professional. You're right up to a point to say they were all amateurs. If I had to put it in a telegram form, I'd say, you're almost right, I think. Lawrence was an amateur. Percy Cox was not an amateur. It's not a value judgment. He's not a better human being. But Cox was a professional diplomat. Anyway, we could explore this later on. I'd like to say something else, and it's maybe
can
even...
Can I just respond to that?
Well, if you don't because mind, I mean, there's lots of... Okay.
By all means, respond later on. I feel confident that you will, but I'm going to say something... I'm going to say something that's no less risky, maybe even more risky.
But please be quick, because I can.
I think Hugh Bell was daddy, And it struck me while listening to you both that maybe the British Empire was Big Daddy. And the relationship between a daughter and daddy, for her at that time, was one of obedience. And I suggest that we can see in various points of the story, particularly the story in Baghdad that interests us, a tension between Gertrude Bell as a human being and as a loyal imperialist. I'll give you one brief example. She very much liked Yasin al-Hashimi, but he wasn't cooperating with the British authority. Now, whenever, and this is my last sentence, whenever there's a tension between her humanity and her imperialism, the imperialism always wins out. She's loyal to Big Daddy, first to last.
Okay, thank you. The mic.
The extraordinary closeness to her father, and her father, of course, didn't want to run the family business. He wanted to go into Parliament. He had very serious political ambitions, which were frustrated by Lothian Bell. But he managed to overcome those frustrations by the steady stream of guests through Rowton. I think it's important to mention the London base in 95 Sloane Street, which occasionally sounded like a tube station at rush hour. I mean, the British establishment were just pouring through it. And the political establishment, and then I think also her closeness to the Lascelles family, to whom she was related, which gave her this in the Foreign Office, and obviously Tehran, Bucharest, and then finally Berlin, because, I mean, Frank Lascelles was a very senior diplomat by the end. So she was really used to holding her own in political argument, I think even before Oxford, and being as good as any man. And similarly with her archaeological career, which was almost accidental through David Hogarth's sister, Janet, with whom she was at Oxford. It was that kind of golden age, was it passed now, of archaeology and these extraordinary personalities like David Hogarth. She stayed on that extra week at Melos, and while she wasn't strictly a dirt archaeologist, she certainly held her own against some of the most distinguished archaeologists of the day. I mean, William Ramsay hugely respected her. She became almost, I mean, she was more than an amateur epigrapher. And then, of course, there's that wonderful picture of her with Woolley, Leonard Woolley, a very frustrated Leonard Woolley, with the findings from Ur. And she had this unerring eye, sort of a court-old art historian's eye, for picking out the best objects, which he had hoped she wouldn't, and that these would end up in the British Museum, and they ended up in Baghdad.
I'd just like to contextualize her feminine form in the desert, in as much as having been privileged to have worked in Yemen sort of at the end of the 20th century, all female professionals were considered men by the Arabs in Yemen. And I think, you know, there's a bit of over-romanticization about her being alone in the desert in that respect. So that's all. Thank you.
Okay, I'll take one more. Yes, please.
I'm wondering whether Gertrude Bell ever had any conversation or correspondence with Pitt Rivers. It seems to me, I mean, he was the father of British archaeology. It was a gross subject at the time, and people became conscious of the antiquity of man through Origin of Species. But the work of Pitt Rivers and the First Ancient Monuments Act in 1882 stimulated an awful lot of people to become more interested in archaeology. And it's just interesting to reflect whether Gertrude Bell was ever part of that galère or whether it was entirely her own initiative.
Thank you. I'm going to take a second round, so if I could ask you to very briefly reply to the points that you'd like to raise. Tamar, you would like to start?
I just wanted to say I very much agree with her, the Big Daddy being the British Empire. In fact, being an atheist, I think it was the closest thing she had to God, the British Empire. That's how I would put it. So it was her church. That was God and the church for her. Very much so, and I think we see that in how the empire always wins through whenever there's a personal interaction, so I do agree with that. On the point of her being, I didn't suggest that she was an amateur archaeologist, I just meant to point out that...
Yeah, but I just think that's also interesting that even within archaeology, she still, you know, if you like, drew her own paths. She stood apart, and I think that's what's interesting. Is I think there's a need constantly to be special, to be separate, to be different, to be better, to be. And I think that's just food for thought. Not yeah. I don't know that I think the over romanticization of her in the desert. I mean, I do agree with you, and I experienced being also an honorary man. Put most of my time in Iraq, actually. But I do think it's something that she wrote about. So it's basically following the cue of what she described and how she felt. So I don't know that actually I don't agree that it was over romanticized necessarily. She was a nomad. She fled to the desert very often. And increasingly, and so I think there's something more there than just kind of the interest in objects or archaeology or so on. There was something that allowed her to, and you know, she start and into the progression. She goes to Persia, but then when she continues, takes her next journey to the east, it's to the Ottoman Empire, it's to the cities, and then she eventually makes her way to the desert, and that's where she's. That's she finds herself at home there. So I do think there is something there that's beyond just her being, you know, a woman being an honorary man in the Orient or in the desert.
Thanks, Tamara.
I think the question about pit rivers is very interesting, and perhaps our archaeologists in the next panel could address that. I simply don't know the answer to that one. The comment about her discernment, her ability to discern quality in the artifacts that she was looking at, I wonder if we could reconfigure perhaps this rather fruitless debate about amateurism versus professionalism in terms of expertise, actually, and that might be a more fruitful approach to this.
Thank you. Okay, I'm taking another round. Lady there, and then...
I'm rather curious about her relationship to other women. The woman that taught me ancient history at UCL died at 101 last year. Her mother was Lady Drower. Her mother and father met Gertrude Bell, and Peggy said to me, she dismissed my mother. She says, my mother wrote 13 novels and also was the Mandaean specialist and wrote the Mandaean dictionary. And she said, I have no time for her.
Interesting.
Can you say your names when you take the phone?
Yes. Moayed Hanoush. Please correct me if I'm wrong, but didn't she join the anti-suffragettes because, not because she was anti-women or anti-women's rights, but because she believed that women's the suffragettes were not asking for enough rights? She did say that. She said something about that she wanted them to ask for more than just be have freedom from the kitchen and the bedroom.
Okay, I'm going to take two more, Magnus in the back and Saad in the front.
Magnus Bernardsson, I have a question about Lord Cromer and Gertrude Bell, because Cromer's writings are very interesting in the sense that when he was writing about women in the Middle East, he was essentially a feminist or very concerned with their plight, but then wasn't as concerned about the status of women at home, presumably Lord Cromer. So I was wondering if you could comment on Gertrude's writing about Middle Eastern women. How concerned was she about their plight in terms of law, legal status, and education? So was she sort of a Cromer-esque in her sort of analysis of Middle Eastern women?
Okay, can we have a microphone here, please?
Thank you. Saad Iskander, my question is to Dr. Tamara. You talked about the relations between Bell and Faisal. What about the Baghdadi officers? You know, I noticed that she respected them a lot, I think because they were semi-Westernized, wearing Western costume, unlike Ja'far Abu Timman. He used to wear Baghdadi costume, and she hated him a lot, although he was the most respected politician in the history of the Iraqi state. The second thing is to you. When she went to Kurdistan, she wrote to her father, saying she felt she was in love with Kurdistan, country, and people. I think she deleted men and put people.
Interesting. Okay, I'm going to take one more, please, lady.
It somewhat relates to Saad's point, I think, here. And my question is, when we look at our relationship with Arab men, you know, as opposed to looking at it as a whole, to what extent did perhaps her support of, say, the Sunnis versus the Shia in forming the government relate to her access to those different groups of male men? And I think, if I recall from my readings about her, there were times when she didn't meet with certain ulema because she had to be veiled, and she would never do that. And so was her lack of access or conversation with them, did that influence her policy making in Iraq? And if anybody had any thoughts on that.
Okay. Thank you. Tamara.
She didn't have time for women, generally. I think one of the women that I didn't have time to talk about, but I suspect informed him somewhat, and she admired tremendously, was Lady Anne Blunt, who went to Ha'il 30 years before, did this dramatic journey, who was granddaughter of Byron, had written about the, you know, pilgrimage to Najd and about the Arabian Bedouins, and her claim to fame is really the crab at horse stud and bringing the Arabian horse to Britain with her husband. She and I actually tried to compare notes between pilgrimage to Najd, for example, by Blunt, which was co-written with her husband. Needless to say, Blunt didn't travel alone. She traveled with her husband. And Gertrude was very keen to meet her, and they cultivated a relationship. So I think looking up to her, up to, you know, that distance in age maybe took away a certain competition or allowed for sympathy. But I was interested to compare, for example, her reactions to Ha'il and Blunt's comments when they arrived there. But it's a bit difficult because Gertrude wrote letters and a diary about it, I mean, in her diary, whereas Blunt published a book. So whereas Gertrude was much more interested, and maybe this goes back to the point about her aesthetics, in how Ha'il looked in terms of the castle, the building, the room she was in, the courtyard, the space, the architecture. Blunt was much more interested in the jewelry of the women, much more than the mention of the Circassian Turkia who Gertrude met during her stay there. She had a close friend in Jane Hogarth, the Hogarth, who was her colleague at Oxford, so maybe an equal of sorts intellectually. She was very close to her stepmother, who informed a lot of her education, in fact. She loved her, in terms of her family, I don't think she treated them quite the same way. But she had a way of dismissing women, you know, that lovely little woman. You know, she was very scathing of a lot of the wives of the British officers who went out to Iraq, thought they were just total, idiots, you know, completely. So, and I think linked to that is I forget what Iraqi women, and if she tried, you know, like Cromer, if she tried to do anything for the lot of women, and I think she did. I mean, she was very interested in at least within the circles that she mixed with more directly, the women of the wives of the Iraqi Arab officers, of the Sharifian officers in Baghdad, even the royal women. She was very interested in them getting a proper education. You know, the library in Baghdad. She, you know, was interested in women reading, but within, I don't think it was a, you know, her primary cause and mission, but it was within the context of creating the state, believing that women should be educated, should be able, should be conversant in society, and so on. Yes, she was friends with the Sharifian officers. She particularly liked Jafar al-Askari, who she got to know better, and Nuri Sa'id, Nuri Pasha, at Paris, at the peace conference, and also in Cairo. She didn't like Jafar Abu Timan because it was he, but I'm not sure that she didn't like him because of the fact that he was more traditional. I mean, she, for example, has, in her letters, she visits one particular Shia alim, mullah, I mean, religious sayyid in the city of Kazimiya, which is now part of Baghdad, Sayyid Hassan al-Sadr, who's the father of then Sayyid Muhammad, who becomes the head of the Senate later on. And she has incredible, I mean, she's very complimentary of him. She actually likes his company. She enjoys it. So, and in that instance, to be honest, I'm not sure whether she actually was covered or not. I think there were moments and moods. I'm not sure that she refused to cover absolutely. Because I think with both Sunni and Shia religious men, it was, I don't think that was kind of a compromise on that. I mean, you need, you know, women need to cover still. I mean, it's one of the issues. But for example, she wasn't very fond of Faisal's officers who were not Iraqi. Like, for, you know, there was Rustam Haider, she didn't like him, Hussein Afnan. So, and they were wearing Western clothes and so on. So I don't think there is necessarily a straightforward position on her attitude to them. Okay, sorry.
I'm just looking at the image of the pot on the back wall, and I'm thinking about what force and energy it takes to break a mould. And I think her the exaggeration of personality, i.e. harsh verdicts on people, including other women, are indicative of the exaggeration of force of personality she had to acquire to do something different, which isn't to justify it. But I would question whether niceness is the right historical criteria to be judging. Do we judge men in quite the same way? I don't know. Probably do, but it strikes me this is something that's used to beat her with quite frequently. She just wasn't very nice. Well, there are reasons for that. Yeah. And she did support women's education in Baghdad, Muslim women's education, in response to your question. But I think that's very much within the mode of Lady Bell, you know, charitable, appropriate philanthropy for certain appropriate educational ends. You know, it's not about turning them all into fierce doctors or professionals in their own right. Yeah.
Great. Well, please share with me in thanking the two speakers.